funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do so many legendary writers have histories of heavy drinking? And do they manage to do their best work because of their use of alcohol or despite it? My guest today has traveled all over the United States to visit the places familiar to John Cheever, Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tennessee Williams, and others, and to try to understand the nature of the hold that drinking had on their lives and their work. The new book by writer and critic Olivia Lang is called The Trip to Echo Springs, On Writers and Drinking. She joins us now from Argo Studios in New York City. Olivia, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
What got you thinking about the number of great writers known to have been problem drinkers?
It's a subject I've been interested in for a very long time. I grew up in an alcoholic family, and when I was a teenager, when I was around 17, I read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at school, and there was something about that presentation of an alcoholic family that goes on in that play that really struck me. So from then on, I became fascinated by the subject of alcohol in literature, and gradually it dawned on me that many of the people who are writing about it suffered from alcoholism themselves. So it's been a sort of slow gathering project, but like you say, there are an awful lot of writers who have suffered from alcoholism over the years. It was a vast list to pick from.
And indeed, the people that you profile here do appear to suffer greatly. But then there are figures like Ernest Hemingway, who used alcohol very heavily, but never seemed to acknowledge that it caused him any sort of trouble.
For a long time, that's true. He absolutely was in denial. He had an extraordinary constitution. He could drink an awful lot. And he seemed to be getting away from it. But I think there does come a point where he starts to acknowledge it. And that's when he's writing A Movable Feast quite late in his life. And at that time, as I was sort of digging away through doctors' records and diaries and letters and so on, I started to realise that he really had hit a problem with his drinking. His doctor had been horrified by his physical state. He'd been horrified by the state of his liver in particular. And he'd put him on a diet of no alcohol. And that, I think, is when Hemingway really encountered the reality of his addiction, because he found it agonising. There are these extraordinary letters that he wrote where he's describing how desperate he feels without a drink, how drink has always been this prop that's been available to him, this source of pleasure in his life, and now he's not allowed it, and how is he going to get on? And I think that's the moment where he really realises he has a problem with drinking.
And there's a fascinating, I think, element to his denial over the years until that time, because he never shied away from calling out F. Scott Fitzgerald on his problem drinking.
I think many alcoholics like to have their pet alcoholic who's worse than them. That can be quite a comforting sort of thing. And Fitzgerald was very much Hemingway's. So you get these sort of, they really, when they first met, they were very, very good friends. They really did love each other. They loved spending time together. But as time went on, Hemingway becomes quite bullying in the friendship. Fitzgerald really did get into trouble with his drinking quite early on. He also had all kinds of other things going on. His wife, Zelda, was having mental health problems. She was in an asylum. She attempted to kill herself several times. He was bringing up their daughter alone. And his drinking went off the rails. And Hemingway, rather than being the sort of comforting friend, was just repulsed by the lack of self-control. He found it really quite grotesque, I think. But he also used it as a way of evading his own drinking. And what's interesting is that period I was talking about earlier, where he's encountering the realities of his drinking, what he chooses to do then is sit down and write A Movable Feast, which is very much casting Hemingway's... This is a memoir about their time in Paris together, Hemingway and Fitzgerald in Paris in the 20s. And it casts Fitzgerald as a pathetic lightweight who can't manage to drink anything, whereas Hemingway is this great macho drinker and it doesn't touch him. And it's so interesting that he's writing that at a time when he really has had to acknowledge that he himself is an alcoholic.
And if Hemingway had asked anyone he was close to in his life, they certainly would have said that they had been harmed by his drinking.
I think so. And I think if you look at his wives in particular, that he just kind of ricocheted from marriage to marriage. His children certainly suffered from... I think his boys absolutely adored him, but I think they also suffered from his drinking, his bad temper when he was drinking. And when you look at his last wife, Mary's memoir, she talks about... She, again, adored her husband, but she talks about terrible scenes, terrible fights and accusations and violent language. And it's horrifying. It's very hard to square that with the sensitive writer in glasses sitting at his typewriter putting together something as beautiful as For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Why focus on American writers rather than British writers? Or French or German writers, for that matter?
I think it's different drinking in Britain. There were no shortage of them. I mean, I could have written about Dylan Thomas, I could have written about Louis MacNeice, I could have written about Kingsley Amis. But I think it's less of a mythic story in the UK. And I think the American story is so rich. These are such terrific writers and they write so much about alcohol in their work that it seemed to me it really belonged here. It was more relevant to look at it here.
So tell us about planning your itinerary and what made it so important to you to physically travel to the places that were familiar to the writers that you discuss here.
What I wanted to do is I wanted to structure... There are books about writers and alcohol that have been written in the past, and they tend to deal with their subjects chapter by chapter. And I noticed that meant that there was a sort of repetitive feeling to them because they all go through the same cycle. So I wanted to structure this around the cycle of alcoholism itself, to look at the phases of alcoholism, which are things like the intoxication, the full-blown alcoholism, the kind of crisis stories where we see the suicides that happen, the ending of marriages, all of these sort of disasters that you get, and then look at recovery. So that was my kind of base structure. And I then plotted that basically over a map of America, going from place to place that these guys had lived in, had travelled through, had loved. The reason that that was so important to me was because landscape was important to all of them. It's important in their work and it was very important in their lives. And I think while I was dealing with this sort of darker elements of their lives, which could potentially be quite exposing, I really wanted to remember the good about them as well. And it seemed to me that their responsiveness to landscape, their relationship with landscape, captured what was best about them, and that let me remember that and remind the reader of that as well. I think it would have been a very different book if I hadn't been doing that.
It's fascinating the way, to differing degrees, these writers use alcohol as a subject or dance around it. Sometimes it's very direct. Sometimes it's used as metaphor. Can you talk about the short story, The Swimmer?
Of course, yeah. The Swimmer is one of John Cheever's most famous stories. And to my mind, it really is one of his greatest stories as well, although I think most of John Cheever's stories are pretty incredible. He wrote it at a low point in his own drinking, and it's about a man, Neddy Merrill, who he wakes up one morning on a Sunday after a party at a neighbour's house, and he comes out, he's feeling fantastic. He sees the swimming pool, he's a passionate swimmer, and he has this great idea. He's going to swim home to his own house by way of his neighbour's pools. It's a kind of friendly neighbourhood, the sort of neighbourhood that we always get in Cheever's stories. And off he goes. Each house that he travels through, each garden that he travels through, there tends to be a party and there tends to be some drinks. So he drinks a few drinks. He describes this as the habits of the natives. And he's having a lovely time. It's the middle of summer. And then gradually something strange starts to happen. It starts to get colder. It starts to feel autumnal. And it's still the same day, but the houses are sometimes abandoned, sometimes empty. He can't make sense of this. And when he does encounter people, there's an oddness to the encounter. Sometimes they're rude to him. There's mentions of him owing money. There's mentions of his poor wife and daughters. There's this sense that something's going on that he can't remember. And he carries on making his way home. It's colder and colder. He's in his swimming trunks and he's really feeling pretty low. And then he gets to his own house and he walks up the driveway and it's locked and the house is empty and it's clear it's been empty for a long time. in that story, which is so short and so surreal and slippery and wonderful, you really get a sense in a very compressed way of the kind of downturn that alcohol can cause in a life, because it's very clear that Neddy Merrill is an alcoholic and that alcohol has caused his losses.
Your account of the months that John Cheever and Raymond Carter were colleagues at the University of Iowa is, if you'll pardon the expression, sobering. talk about their time together and how they spent it.
Yeah, it's so they were both working there at the same time. They were both professors there teaching creative writing. And Cheever was at a high point of his career. He was very well known. Carver was less well known. Cheever had just come out of hospital for drink-related heart attack. He was in very poor physical shape, but he was still drinking. They were both clearly addicted to alcohol. And their first encounter is fascinating. There's a knock at Raymond Carver's door and he opens it and there's John Cheever, you know, his hero, standing outside. And he says, pardon me, do you think I might borrow something to drink? And Carver thinks, oh,
kindred
I see
spirit.
How this is going. Yeah. Kindred spirit. And so he pours him an enormous glass of vodka and says, would you like some juice in that? And Cheever says, oh, God, no, and knocks it back. And they immediately see, right, this is it. I've found an ally. Off we go. And they spend the entire time there drinking. They don't take the covers off their typewriters. And there's an amazing story that Carver tells in a Paris Review interview of them both driving to a liquor store. And John Cheever hasn't even put socks on. It's freezing cold Iowa in midwinter. And they're driving to the liquor store at 9 a.m. And Cheever jumps out of the car before it's parked, before it's stopped moving. And the clerk is opening the store and he's right in the second it gets there. And it's kind of a funny story and it's kind of a terrifying story as well.
Well, I think what struck me about that is that, you know, okay, so it's Raymond Carter and John Cheever. And so there's this gloss of romanticism that we put over it and we can be amused by it. But that's only because we know that they produced this amazing work. If they had failed as writers or if they were, you know, professors of history or biochemistry or whatever, the story just becomes pathetic. There's no other way to explain it.
Absolutely. That's so true. And I think also we're privileged. We have this sort of odd thing that we only know them as these writers. When we see the consequences in their lives, when we see their children, when we see their wives, it becomes a lot less pleasant. And I think that's what I was at pains to do with the book, was to show the wider context of what their drinking was doing, to try and strip away some of that glamorizing mythology, which I'm very suspicious of, and to see what was really going on and what kind of damage alcohol was causing in their lives.
Carver said some really just lacerating things about his children and effectively blamed them for his drinking problem.
That was horrifying coming across that. I was writing at that stage about recovery and I really wanted it to be a sort of perfect story of recovery. I wanted him and Cheever to become, because they both did get sober, and that is exceptional. It's very impressive. But I kind of wanted them to be completely transformed characters. And of course, nobody is going to completely change. So Raymond Carver, after he got dry, he was at Yaddo, the artist's residency, and he wrote an essay called Fires. And in that, he talked very bitterly about the poverty that he'd gone through, the experience of raising children when he was absolutely broke and he wanted to be a writer, but he couldn't. He had to just get food on the table. And obviously that's upsetting, but he blamed his kids for it.
My guest is writer and critic Olivia Lang. Her new book is called The Trip to Echo Springs, on writers and drinking. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and critic Olivia Lang. Her new book is called The Trip to Echo Springs, On Writers and Drinking. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you write candidly and not without compassion about your mother's ex-partner, Diana, who lived with your family when you were a child for a number of years and who eventually got sober. But I wonder how much your experiences within the turbulence of that relationship that was affected by heavy drinking might cause you to have less empathy than anyone else as to the sort of creative magic of alcohol.
I wonder if that's true. Yeah, I think it was a very frightening period of my childhood, and it was definitely quite damaging. But at the same time, it left me very keen to understand, and I think that keenness to understanding is something that drives the writer generally, that sort of desire to get below the surface of something. And I think as well, there's something about watching someone go through recovery. There's something about seeing how bad addiction can be and then seeing how hard it is to get sober and watching somebody do it that inevitably is going to leave one with compassion. It's a humbling thing to see. I don't want to sort of romanticize it, but I think it is an absolutely extraordinary act. And so I think that was very foundational for this book and very foundational to my approach, was the knowledge of how hard it is to get sober and the belief that it is possible.
From the accounts you give here, you seem to be a very modest drinker. Like, I guess you'll have a beer now and then. Have you ever tried writing while intoxicated just to see what that feels like?
I don't know. I don't know how modest. I mean, I'm not a hard drinker at all, but I definitely do drink, and it didn't stop my drinking reading about all of this. I'm very aware that there's a difference between the social drinker and the alcoholic, yeah. And thank God that's not something I suffered from. But though any time I've tried it, it's been absolutely hopeless. I think it really is a hard thing to do. But that's another myth as well, that I think when we think about writers and drinking, we assume that they were writing drunk. And that's actually pretty rare. Most people tend to do their drinking after the writing day is over. And it seems very much about a way of changing the channel, changing the tune, rather than being a source of inspiration in itself. It's much more about managing other things like anxiety, depression, social unease, rather than directly being used as a stimulant for creativity. Obviously, there are exceptions to that, but out of the six that I was writing about, it seems like only Fitzgerald really made a habit of writing drunk.
I guess when you spend long hours of every day deep within your own imagination, one of the likely consequences for a certain type of personality would be anxiety and rumination.
I guess, and I think also that it's more of a chicken and egg thing. I think the kind of kids these guys were tended to be pretty anxious, often quite unpopular. Somebody like Fitzgerald really wasn't that popular among his friends, nor was Cheever. But they have this fabulous compensatory gift, which is that they're really good at making up stories. And kids love being told stories. So this is their sort of source of popularity, source of acceptability. Mm. They tend to be kind of fantasists. They tend to be quite escapist. And all of them suffered from extreme anxiety, extreme unease, and in later life as well, depression. Alcohol becomes a magnificent way initially of medicating that sort of thing. And it seems to me that the creativity and the desire to drink are therefore coming out of a sort of similar place, a similar kind of personality. And that was really interesting to see.
So let's talk about poor Tennessee Williams. He actually said people either drink because they are very frightened of something or because they can't face the truth. How did those statements apply to his own life?
That's interesting because that's from a letter that he wrote to Elia Kazan about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is very much focused on trying to understand the alcoholism of a character. And at the time, Tennessee Williams was really struggling with his own alcoholism. He was really aware of how bad it was, of the kind of detrimental effects it was having on his creativity. Because let's not forget, alcohol is a poison with appalling effects on the brain. It affects memory, it affects concentration, it affects the ability to structure. So it's really detrimental long term to a creative person. And I think at that point, alcohol was just overwhelming him. You can see him being capsized by it. And he pours those feelings into the play. He's capable of pouring those feelings into the play. But at the same time, he's absolutely incapable of reining himself in and stopping.
Do you think that Williams, I mean, struggling with his sexuality, was that a catalyst for his drinking in the first place?
I don't think so. The extraordinary thing about Tennessee Williams is he was out and proud his whole life. He came out very young. He seems to really have been very uncomplicated about it. I don't think it was a source of great anxiety for him. He knew that he was gay, he knew that he desired men, and he was fine about that. And when you think of the time that he lived in, that really does seem quite impressive. And you can contrast that to John Cheever, who likewise desired men, but married, had children, was totally committed to maintaining this facade of being a heterosexual man when really his erotic desires were very much about men. And he couldn't admit that himself. He felt so much shame about it. And it seems that his drinking was driven by a desire to conceal it, to wash away, to drown out those sort of feelings, that sort of need. But Tennessee Williams is only a tiny bit, they're very similar in age, and Williams was absolutely accepting of his own sexuality, which I think is really impressive.
In order to fully understand all of these experiences that these writers had, you did a lot of scientific research, or you read a lot of scientific research into the effects of addiction on the body and the brain. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned about, you know, it's one thing to be intoxicated on a particular night. It's another thing to make a habit of it over years and years. And there are long-term deleterious effects.
Absolutely. I talked to all kinds of people. I went to visit a psychiatrist who runs what's now called the Addiction Institute in New York, but was called Smithers. And that's where John Cheever went to dry out, and also Truman Capote. I talked to neurobiologists, I went to AA meetings. So I spent a lot of time trying to understand what alcohol actually does. And it's very interesting, the initial effects of a drink on the brain suppress brain activity. They cause an immediate cessation in brain noise, brain chatter. And so people who suffer from a sense of anxiety, a sense of unease, a sense of paranoia, any of those things, are immediately going to feel liberated by it, are immediately going to feel soothed, their confidence increases, their inhibitions fall away, they're much more socially buoyant. So you can see why somebody would discover this substance, as Tennessee Williams did, and think, this is it, this is a miracle. The problem comes when you keep using alcohol, because the brain adjusts to it. And so the neurotransmitters that cause the sense of anxiety are stronger and stronger and stronger, which means when one stops drinking, all those feelings that you're trying to push away rise up like a tidal wave, causing a crushing anxiety. And this is something that we see in Tennessee Williams' journals and in John Cheever as well, in John Cheever's journals. If he stops drinking for an afternoon, he'll say, if he stops drinking for a day, by the afternoon, he'll feel this dreadful feeling. He'll be certain that all kinds of terrors are about to befall him. And so this is the sort of vicious circle that drives alcoholism. The tolerance means that you keep needing to drink and drink more and drink more. And then the other side to that is that ethanol is a poison. It's poisonous to all the organs of the body, and it's particularly poisonous to the brain. So we're seeing all kinds of detrimental effects. And things that a writer absolutely needs, like memory, like cognition, like clarity, like the ability to structure, like a clear and powerful use of language, all of that starts becoming damaged. So you really see the sort of architecture of the body crumbling over the years.
Well, was it Hemingway who said, write drunk, edit sober?
But I don't think he actually did it.
It was just a way, again, of normalizing. Or maybe, early on, it just doesn't seem like he felt compelled to make any excuses whatsoever.
I think early on, he had a remarkable constitution. And I think early on, it really was a source of pleasure. And it's important to remember as well the context of time, that he's coming from an America that at that time is very puritanical in the 20s. And he's going to Europe, where suddenly drinking is much more normalized anyway. It's much more a source of pleasure. He says often that he thinks of alcohol as a kind of food, a source of pleasure in his life. And he relishes it. So when he's talking about racing around Paris or Spain, drinking these marvellous wines and brandies and champagnes, he is having the time of his life. It's wonderful. It's absolutely intoxicating. It means all sorts of things happen, because you must remember, alcohol is a real motor of events. It makes things happen. You're drunk, suddenly you find yourself kissing a girl. All of these sort of things happen to him over and over again. The problems come much later. And then I think it's already too late, because you're addicted. So it's very, very hard to rein in and to stop drinking at that kind of stage.
I don't want to push the comparison too far, but there's such focus required to write for a living and write well, and it takes so much time and effort. Is there something about the nature of writing that is in itself like an addiction?
Gosh, I wonder. I mean, I think there's statements by Cheever where he says, you can feel he's asking himself a tough question. I wonder if the escapism of alcohol and the escapism of fiction have something to do with each other. And you can sense that he's thinking, all I do is run away from where I really am. And sometimes it's I run away into the bottles of gin in the pantry. And sometimes it's I run away into making up these fictions, these fabulous stories. And I think later on he came to think one of those is healthy, one of those is good, solid work, and one of those isn't healthy. But I think there really are all kinds of similarities and commonalities between writing and drinking. You can see that they're both ways of handling and processing material in one's life that are difficult. And I think often with these writers, you see them take painful experiences and place them into their fictions, transmute them into their fictions. And it's tempting to wonder whether they're doing something similar with the drinking, whether drinking is a way of burying difficult feelings, escaping difficult feelings. So I think there's a strong relationship between the two.
To what extent does regret play out in their work, given that, you know, one who drinks too much inevitably is going to offend people on a regular basis or say or do things that if not drunk, they might never have considered?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the perfect example for that is the poet John Berryman, who almost made a career out of regret, that you see him regularly doing terrible things. He'd phone up students. I mean, he was a wonderful teacher as well. I want to be very clear about that, and a wonderful writer and very much loved by the people in his life. But at the same time, as an out-of-control drunk, he'd flirt with students, seduce students, threaten to kill students, all in blackouts. He'd wake up in the morning and find that the night before he'd rung up a student and told them that he was going to kill them. That kind of thing is going to make an extraordinary feeling of regret, an extraordinary feeling of guilt. And of course, the first thing that one does in that state is think, I need a drink, I need a drink. And that becomes yet another motor. So I think this is how alcoholism progresses, is that because it's causing more and more damage, the only thing that one thinks will save one from that kind of damage is to drink more, to drink more, to drink more. And obviously, that isn't the correct answer, but it can certainly seem like a very tempting one for a very long time.
It just seems so strange, Olivia, that people who need professionally to access deep emotion and strong feelings, when faced with those same things in their real lives, find themselves unable to cope. It would almost seem like a writer would be better suited to coping with these emotions than the average person.
I wonder if it's rather like actors, though, that we sort of think that actors are full of deep feelings because they're so good at expressing them for us, but they're not necessarily, or comedians aren't necessarily funny in their real lives. I think writers might have very strong feelings, have an ability to access very strong feelings, but might also find them incredibly frightening. And in fact, the frighteningness might be why they want to put them down, why they want to explore them and examine them at such length. Because I think people who are ordinarily socially buoyant might not need to be writing that much in the first place.
Did any of them worry that quitting drinking would affect the quality of their work?
If you look at those diaries of Cheever's where he's struggling, and they go on for a decade, and they're very, very long, very detailed. It's a sort of vast drama between will he drink at 10 or will he drink at 11 in the morning? This is the sort of thing that's played out. And I think that is definitely one of the questions is, who am I if I'm not drinking? Drinking makes me into the whole person that I believe I am, this big person, this capable person. Long after that's become a lie, there's still this kind of fantasy. And I think for all of them, the idea of stopping was very frightening because would the person who was left be creative? Would the person who was left be interesting? And most of all, would the person who is left be lovable?
It's strange to think about. I mean, they were, you know, there are these amazingly creative, famous writers, but they were also regular human beings. When regular human beings get sober, they often have to find new friends and that sort of thing. How much for Carter and Cheever was that the case?
Cheever carried on his same life. He stayed with his wife. He started a liaison with a young man, and he got much more comfortable about that. I mean, I think that relationship, as anyone who's read Blake Bailey's biography will know, has its own problems and it seems to have been quite coercive. But as far as Cheever was concerned, he was a lot happier. He did carry on writing as well, and I think his best novel, Faulkner, was written after he got sober. So I think he kind of pulled sobriety off. Mm-hmm. Carver, he really walked away from his old life. He left his wife, he left his kids. He went and got dry in a little house on the coast in California. And then he kind of found his way into a whole new life. He met his new wife, the poet Tess Gallagher, and he moved to the West Coast. And he really found a rich second life, I think.
My guest is writer and critic Olivia Lang. Her new book is called The Trip to Echo Springs on Writers and Drinking. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and critic Olivia Lang, author of the new book, The Trip to Echo Springs, on writers and drinking. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, sending a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or calling 1-800-933-5372. I think we've long understood some kind of association between great creative gifts and perhaps a heightened susceptibility to certain forms of mental illness. Is there hard evidence that writers as a whole drink more than any other artists or any more than, you know, bank tellers and school teachers?
Absolutely not. No, I think alcoholism is very well distributed across the world. It can affect people who do any kind of job. I think it's more that writers are particularly articulate and eloquent about exploring it. And I think the reasons that they suffer from it might be different from the ordinary population. Although I think the things about self-medication, about childhood damage, those could affect absolutely anybody. They don't have to win the Nobel Prize in order to suffer from anxiety.
So the reasons you think that writers might have to drink that are different from other people are what?
I think the life itself is particularly stressful. I think it involves an awful lot of solitude and a kind of pressured creativity which has to go on totally alone, totally without any assistance, and then you hand over this baby, this project, to, if you're a novelist, to your editor, if you're a playwright, you hand it over to your director, and then you have to let go of it. You have to let it go through these cycles of editing, of change. And you can see in Tennessee Williams' letters to Walaya Kazan, his director and producer, that that process was agonising for him. He found it absolutely tortuous, that he felt like his work, I mean, sometimes he felt like his work was being magnificently put on, but sometimes he felt that he wasn't being understood, that his thing was being changed. And I think that was very painful. So there's a desire after a day of work for a sort of conviviality, a sort of sociability, a need to just shrug off the tensions. And I think that can lead to those sort of dangerous habits, which you can see so clearly in somebody like Hemingway, that he'll get up very early in the morning, work very hard, and then run out to, when he's living in Key West, Sloppy Joe's, and really start hammering back the daiquiris with this great desire to just get out of the channel that he's been stuck in and into something else.
For the majority of these writers that wrote sober and then abused alcohol when they were not writing, I mean, is it fair to even ask whether their output would have been different in some way if they had done their writing sober and stayed sober?
I think it is possible to answer that, because I think it's so clear that the late work is damaged by alcohol. I think we can see very clearly where that happens. And if you look at somebody like Tennessee Williams, he writes these plays, Glass Menagerie, Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Night of the Iguana, etc., which were wonderful, which were staged over and over again. By the end of his career, he couldn't get a play on Broadway. Everything he wrote was annihilated by the critics, for good reason, because they're structurally all over the place, they don't make sense, they're repetitive. And he himself felt this was because of damage to the brain caused by alcohol. So that kind of attrition, I think, is something that you could clearly do without. You could clearly sober up and be more productive. And again, we see that particularly with Raymond Carver, who, after he got sober, produced, I think, some of his best short stories and really an incredible body of poetry as well, which is very almost radiant with thankfulness about the sobriety that he's achieved. So it's certainly possible to produce and to be very creatively productive while sober. I suppose there's a larger question here of, would it be worth them not drinking at all? And would we have any of that work if they hadn't been drinking? Would we have For Whom the Bell Tolls? Would we have these sort of great works by alcoholic writers? And that's a much harder question to answer.
Were you afraid the answer might be no?
I think it's very hard for anyone outside of the individual to judge whether it was worth it, because the kind of damage that, the kind of pain, basically, that alcohol caused to the individuals and to the people who loved them is so great that it feels intrusive to make that sort of judgment. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to be certain whether those books would have been better without the influence of alcohol, or whether they wouldn't have existed at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have George on the line in Plano. Hi, George.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Hi. I just wanted to mention as a contribution, I guess, to this idea, that one of my favorite writers in the past was the great mystery, or I guess you'd say private detective writer, Raymond Chandler. And he was, you know, really his whole... everything that he wrote was basically in Los Angeles. And so he started writing, you know, being hired to write some screenplays. And I remember reading that when he was attempting to write the screenplay for the movie The Blue Dahlia, he began falling behind schedule. And they started giving him, you know, putting pressure on him to hurry up and finish so they could get that movie made. And he said, okay, that he would really start going faster, but in order to write faster and still keep his, you know, his ability going, that he pretty much had to do it drunk. And so he started doing it that way, as I understand it, for the maybe the final third or fourth part of the screenplay that he was writing, until he finished the movie and almost, you know, ruined his health by hardly ever eating and just drinking almost constantly as he was doing that.
Well, thanks for your call. Did you want to comment on any of that, Olivia?
That's so interesting. I'm a huge fan of Raymond Chandler, but I hadn't heard that story, and I can believe that it's true. It would be really interesting to get closer up to it, because I wonder whether that's an example of somebody using the "I've got the pressure of work" as an excuse for their drinking, or whether he genuinely found it creatively stimulating. But I'm sure that that's true, and it's really interesting to hear it.
I don't know this about you, but I assume that you socialize with other writers on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Are there any that are reluctant to, say, choose, you know, anti-anxiety medications or antidepressants to sort of quell their bad feelings for fear of ruining their writing?
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I've come to think that that's the thing that we use in our century, that this mm-hmm. is a 20th century story, and the thing we use in our century is medication, actual medication, rather than the sort of self-medication of drinking. So that idea that some people might want to resist that because they feel like it upsets their creativity is really interesting. I don't know anyone personally who has chosen not to take medication because they think that it will upset them. But I remember reading in Kay Redfield Jameson's extraordinary book about mental illness and creativity, which I think is called Touched by Fire. She, remind me, An Unquiet Mind, which is about her own life. She talks about how she's on lithium and she felt that that might stop her from being creative, and then realised actually it's going to save her life and that's much more important. And as it turned out, didn't inhibit her creativity, might have inhibited some of the sort of manic, seemingly wonderful episodes, but in the long term really was much, much healthier.
Hmm. What were there things that you discovered throughout this project that you didn't expect, just on a personal level?
I guess I wasn't, although I knew, I think initially I thought that it would be a much lighter book. When I tell people I was writing about writers and drinking, everyone would sort of go, "Oh, that'll be fun, you know, fun stories." I hadn't really bargained for how bleak it was going to be and how disturbing some of the stories were. The whole situation with John Berryman, his passes through recovery, his suicide, I found that really, really depressing to look at, distressing and depressing. And I suppose I hadn't really bargained for how much it would bring up my own feelings about my childhood and how hard that would be to handle as well. So it was a real emotional process writing this book. It was tough.
Was Berryman, I guess he jumped off a bridge, is that right?
He jumped off a bridge in St. Paul, yeah.
Was he drunk at the time?
No, I don't think he was. He had got sober. He'd been through recovery for the third and final time. He hadn't been drinking, and around New Year, he did get drunk once. I don't think he was drunk when he died. I think he just knew he didn't have it in himself to be able to bear what he had to bear without the prop of alcohol. He knew that he didn't want the prop of alcohol anymore, but he also couldn't find a way to handle the sort of feelings that rose up in him when he was sober. And to me, that's a tragedy.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Tom on the line in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question for the author is, she said other than Fitzgerald, they didn't drink or weren't drunk and drinking, and at the same time they were writing. I was wondering, during the period that they were focusing on their writing, did they curtail or have a better control on their alcoholism? And then when they finished a book, the alcoholism really manifested itself, binge drinking, etc.
That's an interesting question. Thanks for your call.
That's a really interesting question. I'd actually quite like to go back through and see that in more detail, because I think they definitely go through binge cycles and then cycles of sobriety. But I think certainly if you're looking at something like Tender is the Night, the production is very much aided by Fitzgerald's drinking. I think the drinking, the writing process is often so hard in itself, they were finding it so hard themselves, that a lot of drinking needed to be done around the edges of it to keep it going, to keep the production moving. I'm not sure about the cycles between books. I'd really have to spend some time sort of looking at diaries to work that out, but that's a really interesting question.
In the times that they were writing and drinking, I mean, you know, the earlier parts of the 20th century were not known for sort of interventions the way the later parts were. I mean, how often did they, were they absolutely confronted by someone in their lives who really wanted them to stop?
I think Fitzgerald is a good example of that because people noticed very early on that he wasn't coping with his drinking. It was very flamboyant, his alcoholism. His life was very short anyway. He was only 40 when he died. And it was obvious that he was absolutely heading for disaster. So people like his editor, Max Perkins, who he shared with Hemingway, were very solicitous, very concerned about his drinking. His friends were concerned about his drinking. His relationship with his wife is trickier because she had her own problems, and it seems often that she pushed him towards drinking, that she, or at least this is the sort of the way the story goes, is that she was jealous of his creativity, and so she would prefer to see him drinking to being sober. But the kind of intervention that we know now was just unheard of then, and people were much more accepting of drinking generally. People were drunk a lot more often. If you read Cheever's stories, you get the sense of this kind of social world that's very like Mad Men, actually, where people are drunk in the office, people are drunk, you know, in the morning. People are doing things with alcohol, are using alcohol in ways that to us now seem staggering and dangerous. And to them were just normal social behaviour.
It's clear reading the book that you have great admiration for the work of your subjects. But I wonder if there was any part of you that feels that reading them is ruined now because you can't help but sort of put into context what was going on in their lives at the time. And they were often details that are sad.
There was definitely a point where I felt like I never wanted to read anything by Hemingway again. I just got sick of him. Mm-hmm. It didn't last, though. And I think what has stayed now is a sense of almost awe at the way that they use those elements of their lives and the way that you can, you know, I know their lives really pretty well now, and I'll read a novel, I'll read a play, and I'll see things wash up that I recognise, but utterly transformed. And it's that process of transformation that is the art, and that remains a source of complete fascination to me, how it's possible to turn these scenes of distress and pain into something really quite magnificent.
The new book by writer and critic Olivia Lang is called The Trip to Echo Springs, on writers and drinking. Olivia, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Olivia Lang was with us today from Argo Studios in New York City. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My Twitter feed is at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.